Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Again, welcome to Nightlight. Max Hawthorne is returning tonight, and we'll be discussing his thought-provoking new book, Monsters and Marine Mysteries. You can learn more about him by going to his website, chronosrising.com. Max Hawthorne and Matt Hooper, same initials. Have you ever seen them at different places at the same time? Could they be the same person? We can only be sure if Max never dated Mary Ellen Moffat. How are you, Max?
I'm good. I'm just, you know, picturing myself as Richard Dreyfuss and being led on me. But anyway, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, over the weekend, did you swim with any bow-legged women?
Haven't had any bow-legged women around lately. You know, it's, plus a man of my advanced years. You know, I mean, you gotta pace yourself. You know,
okay.
I mean, like at my age, I get to go to IHOP now, and I get to eat off the senior menu. Can you imagine that? And they look at me like I'm lying, and especially since I'm getting my fat rump back in shape and all. So I'm like, yeah, I'll take this combo here and all. And they're like, we're going to need some ID. I'm like, seriously, this girl, I got socks older than you, and I'm wearing a pair. You want to see them? You know? So anyway, it's all good.
Okay.
So, they are older than some of these kids these days.
Yeah, I have a few like that too. You know, we'll save that for another show. But we better get started on your book before the censors start getting a little antsy about pushing that button for the red flag. But you changed your writing approach from your horror paleo fiction writing to the more documented accounts of marine anomalies for your latest publishing achievement. What's the story behind that?
Well, usually, like you're right, I do like normally my genre is like sci-fi thrillers / horror thrillers, but the Cronus Rising series, which I guess is what they, I mean, actually the hashtag Jaws meets Jurassic Park originated based on Cronus Rising back in like 2014 or something like that. But those books are based on the notion of giant pre-submarine predators being alive in the present in a believable manner and the impact they could have, obviously, on the ecosystem, the ocean's ecosystem based on, you know, us having killed most of our sharks and whales, et cetera. But over the course of writing those books, I end up doing immense research on a variety of marine organisms. And over the course of doing that, I started to uncover research or evidence and reports on assorted marine animals that are unidentified or sometimes misinterpreted or are look like there's something extinct out there that, you know, like something out there that, I'm sorry, that's supposed to be extinct, and it's not. Okay. And I started interviewing people that I encountered who had eyewitness reports. They would sometimes they would reach out to me because they thought nobody else would take them seriously or they were tired of getting laughed at and stuff. And I got on this point where I had done an assortment of blog posts on the topic. And then I thought, well, I can actually do a whole book on this because it's of interest to me and obviously the readers. And then I started collecting data, including I was privileged to interview some fantastic people, eyewitnesses that saw some of these immense, sometimes incredibly large and incredibly dangerous creatures up close and personal. And I mean, some of these people, nobody even knows they're still alive because these sightings took place in the 70s and stuff.
And you do have photos as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I collected a plethora of evidence, everything from images, drawings from eyewitnesses, photographs, if anything was available, charts. I put stuff in the book. I wanted to give everybody as much data as possible, links to all the reference material. We've got photos in there. Like, for example, mega sharks are obviously of ongoing interest to people. And I uncovered evidence of an assortment of enormous macro predatory sharks out there. And this is all like in recent years, in the last, whatever, 5, 10, 15 years, something like that. And these range in size from sharks that are at a minimum of 25 plus feet and possibly as much as 40 feet in length, which doesn't jibe with known maximum sizes, for example, for Carcharodon. Carcharodon is the great white shark. But there's photos in the book there of a peer of mine who found a humpback whale carcass and measured it. He handles whale watching and stuff for his island, and Briar Island to be exact, hence the thing was called the Beast of Briar Island. And that humpback had been fed on by an assortment of sharks, including white sharks and possibly a hammerhead. I mean, I'm sorry, a hammerhead, a tiger. All the photos of all the bite marks and stuff were in there and the carcass. And there were several bites on there that were picture-perfect great white shark bites, but they were gigantic. And I mean gigantic. One of the bites was about 27 inches wide and 31 inches high. And then there was another bite right next to it or under it that was the same width, but was even higher, approximately 39 inches, which of course indicated that the shark on one bite did not have to open its mouth as wide before it got a grip. See, so it had a maximum gape of 39 inches. And going by, went into all the different formulas that are out there for estimating shark size based on bite gape, et cetera. And some of them came up in insane numbers. I couldn't go with those. I wanted to be as conservative as possible. But even going with the most reasonable or the smallest estimates possible, that animal still measured close to 26 feet in length and possibly over 30, to be fair, okay, with some of the formulas that are out there. And these are from elasmobranchologists, shark researchers, okay, and marine biologists. But at least 25 or 26 feet, and that is an enormous shark. I mean, we're talking something that probably weighs like 5-6 tons off the top of my head. You know, the size of like the bigger than Bruce, the shark from Jaws, closer to the one in Jaws 2, let's say. And that was the smallest of the sharks that I researched, and they went up from there, bigger, 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 bigger. I mean, the biggest one is the one, the Galapagos giant, and that was based on photos taken by a marine biologist of underwater of a 40-foot whale shark off the Galapagos Islands. And that whale shark had been attacked by a gigantic shark of some kind. And it had a bite on its caudal keel towards the back like a third of the whale shark, where the predator had attacked it, trying to cripple it. It crunched down on that, and it tried to bite through that region so that it could cripple the whale shark, eliminating its means of propulsion. If you destroy a shark's tail, especially at the part where the all the muscles are, the shark cannot swim. Then it will sink, drown, die, etc. Easy prey. Okay. Also, you avoid retaliation if you're the victim has teeth, etc. That's why great whites, when they go after an elephant seal, which is the same size as them, let's say, they always grab it by the haunches and they crunch down, do the bite and sit thing. You know, they don't want that elephant seal to turn around and rip open their face. They could lose an eye, you know, or even worse. It's a dangerous game. So they do that, then they swim away and they wait for it to bleed out. And this predator probably attempted the same thing, except that its jaws were 4 feet across. And that's based on the notion that that scar tissue that's there shows that, in my opinion, that bite is not that old, like a year, year and a half at most, probably less.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I have links in there to my site where it shows how a whale shark's bite has healed over a period of like 16 months. And the difference is night and day between the bite in the book on this giant shark and the one healed. You could see like this 40-foot whale shark, there are still tooth grooves in that wound, like the actual individual tooth rakes as the predator bit down. And the only reason the whale shark wasn't killed is because the predator, which had to be about the size of it, so we're talking a 40-foot shark, it when it crunched down on that caudal keel there, that is what I call like a crumple zone on whale sharks. It's the enormously thick, like, area of fibrous tissue and skin, which on a shark that size, I think one of the researchers told me it could have been a foot thick. And you have all this thick, gristly tissue that is supporting the whale's tail, whale shark, I'm sorry, but also it's like a barrier. And so when a predator went and grabbed it and crunched down, it didn't get to tear out all the muscles and stuff that the shark swims with. It only got, like, calluses, we'll almost call it, or something like that, which probably didn't taste very well either. And either it let go at this point, spat that out and said, okay, this isn't really tasty, or maybe the whale shark gave it a really hard smack in the head with its own caudal keel, you know, with its tail, and dissuaded it, whatnot. But, you know, obviously the whale shark survived because swimming around with a 4-foot bite taken out of it. So, you know, it was just fascinating stuff. And I was able to put all this together into this book and show people that there's a lot out there that people aren't seeing that it hasn't really made the mainstream, or that people are just so conservative they don't want to say this is what this could be. You know, I have no such compunction. So I'm putting the evidence out there and I'm letting people judge for themselves.
Okay. You're saying, you know, people might not be seeing some things. And I think as many times as you've been on Night Lights, you know, people are expecting stories of mosasaurs and megalodons, but you throw some curveballs at us, approach, and early on in the book, you give us a more interesting animal to fish, mammal to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows up later in the your book as well. Maybe we ought to talk a little bit about Gary LaMotta's observations of
the giant turtle
creature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's get into that. That's something that's new material for the listeners. I thought you made a compelling case.
Thank you. I mean, there are people out there that will claim that, oh, the stills or watching the footage that Gary shot way back in 1969, that's not compelling or some nonsense like that. And yes, the original footage is very grainy and dark I mean, it's from a Super 8 camera that had been seen and watched hundreds of times and left in boxes in an attic or whatever and whatnot, and it got darker over time. But I was able to take stills from that footage and just enhance them with a simple, you know, Windows program where you click enhance photo and then play around with the lighting and stuff until I lightened it up enough that I was able to see what was actually there. And it, even though you'll never get something that's crystal clear or crisp, it's unmistakably the head of a gigantic sea turtle of some kind. And based on Gary's description, obviously a new or undocumented species. This is just, you know, what happened. But I'd have to pull up my notes to get an exact details, but I'm going to try and remember off the top of my head. And keep in mind, I'm, even though I battle incessantly, I'm not a computer, so my memory is not flawless, shall we say. But in 1969, date escapes me off the top of my head, but Gary LaMotta, who was a fisherman off of fishing near Vancouver Island, he and a friend of his took their boats out to go fishing for salmon. It's up there getting salmon runs. And it was very early in the morning. It was a beautiful day. It was flat calm out. And Gary was ahead of his friend Earl, who was, I think he said about a mile behind him or something like that. I got to interview Earl. Gary had passed away years ago, but Earl, thankfully, is still with us. And Earl explained to me that there were some erroneous statements or evidence in some of the previous cryptozoological society reports and stuff. People got the impression that Earl was with Gary and that he worked for him and that sort of thing. And that was definitely not true. They had two separate boats. I got the names of the boats, the size of the boats, the models, all that jazz. And the size of the boat was relative because Earl told me that the animal was as big as their boats. And they had a 38-foot boat as reference, so that was quite compelling too. Not to mention if you're a, you know, a fisherman and you're out on the water all the time, you learn how big boats are over time, inevitably. You can look at a boat and say, oh, that's a 16-footer. You know, that one, that's a 20-foot boat. You know, that's a 28-foot boat, whatever. You'll be pretty close or spot on even, depending on how experienced you are, because you can tell looking at a boat. And when you're looking at a giant marine turtle and you have your boat right under you, obviously, it makes it even easier. But so the images that I pulled up showed that Gary told the truth. And what happened is, apparently, and Earl backed this up, is that Gary, and luckily for us, was a real fanatic with his trusty Super 8 camera, which back in 1969, I guess you'd say, was the iPhone of its day, you know? And so Gary was obsessively filming, you know, all sorts of stuff. You know how it is when you first get your first 35 millimeter camera or whatever it might be, or your first camcorder back in a day or whatever, and you're constantly, like, you know, playing around, taking family videos and shots of your dog, and you see in social media people always posting, you know, home clips, etc. So Gary was doing the same type of thing, and he got out there, and then he started radioing Earl on his walkie-talkie saying, get out of here quick, hurry up, there's a sea monster. And he's like, and Earl's laughing, he goes, I'm serious. He goes, get out here now, hurry up. So Earl, you know, puts it in the gear, and he catches up to him, and Gary has been like drifting at this point, meaning not anchored up and not underway. And the animal, which Gary filmed and described it as being on the surface, and it had its head and neck sticking up out of the water. And when you see the images that I was able to enhance, you could see it has turned, and it's looking at him, which, of course, in retrospect, some of the other stuff I researched is a little unnerving, since this animal was definitely big enough to consume a grown man. I mean, just the head and neck was 8 feet long. But and then Earl said that That's when huge. He got there, the animal had submerged. And under them, there was a rock ledge. I forget how deep the water was in there. I'm going to say like maybe 60 feet or something like that. But this rock outcropping came up from the seafloor, and it came up and reduced that depth by, I think, half or something like that. So it was fairly shallow under them. And the animal...
It went from 10 to 12 fathoms to 6 to 8 fathoms.
Okay, so that's even better. Thank you, because I don't have it in front of me right now. So 10 or 12 fathoms would be 60 to 72 feet, a fathom is 6 feet. Okay. So then you said 10 to 12 to 6 to what? 6 to 8?
6 to 8. Right? It's on page 40.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I don't have the book in front of me. So maybe 36 to 45 or 50 feet, something like that. And they had their boats a few yards apart, and they're looking down, and this thing is just sitting there on the ledge, which is common behavior. If you've ever seen footage of sea turtles when they're not swimming, often they'll go on down to the seafloor. They'll sit there. I've watched them while swimming with them in Hawaii, for example, and they'll clean their faces like a cat does with their flippers. It's quite interesting to see because they look like a cat when they're doing it, the same technique. But they'll sometimes they take naps on the bottom for 6, 7, 8 hours because they can absorb some water, I mean oxygen, through their skin. So this animal was sitting there on the ledge. I don't know what it was doing. It could have been finishing something it caught and eating it, or just chilling out, or wondering why there was these two boats hovering directly above it and what. But and Earl said that at first when he looked at it, he thought it was an impossibly large sea lion. It was a pale color, like really light, like gray, almost whitish. And it had this streamlined look to it. And Gary had described it as being a gigantic shellless turtle capable of terrific speed, as he put it. Okay. And then the animal eventually moved off and it took off very quickly underwater and it was gone. But when you see the footage, you could definitely see first, this is not some strange 40-foot long sea lion. You know, the head, the neck, the beak is unmistakable, and the eyes and the brow ridges, that is definitely some sort of giant turtle, which matches Gary's drawing that he did, which matches his description, et cetera. So it appears, and since there was a lot of salmon running through the area at the time, unless it was there to give birth, I would assume that the creature was feeding on all the fish that were around there and, you know, just got tired of or paranoid about boats being above it, and it just got out of Dodge.
Just to make sure the audience knows that we're talking about something really different is, you know, you said that this may have been some kind of shellless turtle.
Well, think of a leatherback sea turtle. They have like a soft shell. Okay, it's like a thick, firm, leathery type of shell with like ridges in there. It has some bone supports under it, struts, we'll call it, whatever. But it doesn't have a formal hard shell like a green turtle or a loggerhead or something like that. Okay, leatherbacks are very fast. They're the fastest known marine reptile. They could swim at up to 22 miles an hour. And they are also champion deep divers. They've been documented at exceeding 5,000 feet, and they can hold their breath for sometimes 2 hours, I think it is. Again, I don't have all the data in front of me, but they're also champions in terms of thermoregulation. They can keep a sustained body temperature of 32 degrees higher than the surrounding water, which is astonishing. And they do this through a combination of activity levels because they're almost always swimming, and they have a brown adipose tissue and circulatory system that's powered by their flipper movement, et cetera, sort of like countercurrent heat exchange, we'll call it. So they're amazing animals, but they feed on primarily jellyfish. Okay, so their speed, et cetera, is probably more a defensive thing because they have to worry about sharks attacking them at times, which does happen. Leatherbacks are big, but there are bigger sharks out there. They're also, these turtles, leatherbacks are very aggressive. There's a documented incident of one attacking a boat that was filming it, and another one of one chasing off a shark that was like looking at it and thinking about trying to make a move on it. So they're not far from harmless, shall we say. But what Gary saw was a little slimmer. He described his body as being 6 feet across. So that sounds more like a pinniped in terms of a body build than a leatherback, which is still broader. So if this creature did evolve, and I found like in the fossil record, an animal that could possibly have been its ancestor, but it may have evolved as a predator, meaning a piscivore. It's, you know, feeds on fish, let's say. And being large like that, I mean, it could eat lions, mane, jellyfish and stuff, which are very large, but there are some sea turtles that are like the loggerhead, for example, that are more omnivores. They'll feed on fish, small sharks, crustaceans, lobsters, things like that, as well as jellyfish sometimes, and even seaweed or marine plants.
Mm-hmm.
But so it just seems to lend itself to the fact that the possibility of that there is a large predatory turtle out there.
Hmm.
So,
okay. The turtle photos you have in your book on pages 46 and 47.
This is in Monsters and Marine Mysteries, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
They look really cute. Yeah, really interesting that these turtle, this one story of the turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Gary and Earl are saying it's maybe 38 feet long, 8 foot
yeah.
neck.
Eight feet long. Yes, it's a very big animal.
This is monstrous proportions for a turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a very let's say welcoming face in your book.
Yeah.
They're just kind of cute and little. I don't think people. If this is a leatherback turtle.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe it's a leatherback.
It sounds like you've been able to rule out, some seals, some of these other animals that could be a candidate for what Gary and Earl saw. Is the leatherback turtle the best explanation for this animal that they saw?
In terms of its appearance, there really is nothing out there that matches it. Because when you see the animal's head, the head is not like that of a leatherback. It's more like almost like a green turtle's head a bit or something. The leatherback's beak is designed differently than this animal's beak is. It has it looks more like a loggerhead or a green turtle, something like that. Except of course for the size, and then it's a lot slimmer, and Gary DeScroll once again described it as being capable of, quote, terrific speed. I mean, when it took off, it just, and it was out of there. And these animals are very graceful underwater. I mean, if you ever swam with turtles like I have, when they decide they want to get out of Dodge, they just accelerate, and it's a marvel to see. They're only using their fore flippers. It's not like a plesiosaur where they would have fore flippers to propel them, which would have been then even quicker. So, but they're fast, they're nimble, they're agile. The thing he described is frolicking on the surface, playing, et cetera, and all that. And eventually, though, like I said, it got bored and they were nervous and it left. But and to me, it seems like this turtle, like a while back when the whole super predator scare, whatever you want to call it, came around, and there were multiple documentaries on the super predator, and which is all discussed in Monster Marine Mysteries. I encourage people, if you're going to get the book, I mean, either way, the physical book or the Kindle book is fine. But the Kindle book does have some advantages because when you have it, you can click on all the links right there. and pull up any of the reference materials, websites, you know, the scientific data, et cetera, to go along with that. I think you can probably also enlarge images and things of that nature, but, you know, it's you want to have access to the information, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But I don't think that the leatherback corresponds to this animal. It's a specialist. You know, it's designed more or less to eat jellyfish. Its throat is lined with those backward-pointing papillae that look like teeth. So it's a one-way ticket for something slippery, and you know a jellyfish is going to be really slippery. It's like eating Jell-O. Well, it's not that I've ever eaten a jellyfish, but, you know, I can imagine. But but it does, the leatherback does have a lot of features that would suggest that it could be a candidate for the super predator if it was much bigger and was capable of eating a 9-foot shark. See, I mean, the speed is there. The diving ability is there. Shark Alpha, that's what they called the animal, the shark that was killed at the Bremer Canyon years ago, Australia, was chased down into the dark and captured by its attacker about 2,000 or almost 2,000 feet down. So that implies something that's fast, big, and can go to tremendous depths, which we know the leatherback can. Then there was the body temperature, the differential there. And that's another thing that struck me as, you know, suggesting that a leatherback was a super predator. And that was that, like a white shark, for example, like, you know, one of the attempts to, you know, I don't want to say quell the panic, but to, you know, solve the mystery was to claim that in the first documentary, oh, it was just a slightly larger white shark that killed an 8, you know, shark alpha. So instead of it, she's 10 feet long and a 16-footer killed her and ate her. And I thought that was kind of a cop-out because, number one, a 16-footer would have a very hard time catching a 10-footer because the 10-footer would be faster and more maneuverable, you know. So that didn't make sense. And then there's the body temperature differential. Well, first of all, the size. You know, a 16-foot shark cannot eat a 10-foot shark. They could kill it, eat parts of it. So you could say, oh, it ate the dorsal fin and then swallowed the track or whatever. But that then there was all the other aspects. There was body temperature, okay? The super predator had a sustained body temperature of, I think it was 78 degrees. And the water was 46 degrees. A maximum temperature differential, which I put in the book, that a white shark was able to sustain, is able to sustain 5 degrees higher than the ambient temperature of the surrounding seawater, which means it could not, in 46-degree water, have a body temperature of 78 degrees. However, the leatherback, and that there's a scientific paper that I referenced in there, has done that. That exact range, in fact. So that 32-degree differential is capable of having and sustaining. See? So if you think about it now, that once again says, no, it wasn't a bigger shark. It was a leatherback turtle, which still doesn't make any sense. Okay? Then there was the respiration aspect of it. Okay? If the super predator was a bigger great white, or a megalodon, okay, let's say, which would never be able to catch a fast-moving 10-foot white shark, okay, et cetera. But the tracker showed that the predator that consumed shark alpha, after it's fed, came back up to the surface and loitered over the next 8 days between the surface and a depth of approximately 300 feet. So this is the exact same behavior pretty much that an orca does. You know, orcas don't dive deep. Okay, they typically stay in that range there. And this animal was acting like a killer whale, except we know it wasn't a killer whale because it had a body temperature of 78 degrees and an orca's temperature is like yours or mine, not 98. Okay, so whatever it was, then that strongly suggests that it was an air breather and that it was behaving like an air breather. It would need to surface and come down and surface come down. It also showed that it was... it had a very long digestive system. And I believe I covered this in there as well. A white shark typically takes like, I think, 24 to 48 hours to digest a meal, something to that effect. And there's a maximum range in there where it completely empties its entire digestive system. I think it was a little over 3 days. But the super predator took 8 full days to digest shark alpha. And it wasn't feeding after 8. The reason why it just kept hanging out there because it had a full belly. If you just ate a 1,000-pound shark, you know, you're pretty well fed. Maybe even a little more than 1,000. I have to crunch that. But anyway, so, you know, it had a large meal. It took it 8 days to digest it. Then it excreted the what remained, including the tag, which eventually washed ashore. Okay, so all this Now, if we look at the leatherback sea turtle, its digestive system is, I believe, if memory serves, is 6 times longer than other sea turtle species. You know, like a green turtle or a loggerhead or a ribbies or whatever. So if this was a leatherback that ate shark alpha, it would explain how long it took to digest her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all the evidence points to a turtle, except that we can't have a turtle. A leatherback is not as big as a 10-foot white shark, and it might be as heavy or heavier, but it certainly couldn't kill one, most likely. It could maybe drive one off, and it certainly couldn't eat it. And the odds are, in fact, it would be the white shark attacking the leatherback, not the reverse. See? And so, once again, it seems to suggest a turtle. Oh, and there, one other thing I forgot. There was also in there, you saw like this animal, whatever it was that killed the great white, it made multiple attempts to get her over a period of, I think it was a week or two or something like that, because you saw periodically the shark alpha did these tremendous deep dives and then came back. And that says to me that that parallels the behavior that white sharks are known to use when they're one of their kind, one of their number is killed by orcas. This has been shown off the Farallon Islands. Orcas killed a great white there. Every white shark in the area got out of dodge. And one that had a tracking tag showed that as soon as that happened, they somehow sensed the death of another white shark from their natural predator. It dove to 1,500 feet, and it swam all the way to Hawaii and stayed there for the rest of the season. Okay, so they fear orcas that much, so they do that. And that deep dive protects them because the orcas can't dive that deep to go after them, track them down, hunt them, and kill them. But whatever did this was able to. So Alpha, when it saw something coming after her like that, they probably figured this is an air breeder. I'm going to try and use the same technique my instincts tell me will help me escape killer whales. It dove. It worked several times. But the turtle eventually, assuming it was the same animal, okay, you know, either figured out her ploy or managed to, like, cut her off at the pass or who knows what, okay? But something obviously fatal took place thousands of feet down in the dark, okay? So you put all that together. Once again, everything seems to suggest a leatherback, but we know a leatherback's not possible. But then I come across Gary LaMotta's sighting and this footage that shows, basically, in my opinion, after enhancing frames, that it was an immense turtle, that we now have a turtle in the size range that is capable of chasing down, dispatching, and consuming a 9 or 10-foot great white shark. It's, you know, just connecting the dots. All the evidence is there, and there's nothing out there that's been found that matches every single aspect of this. See, it all points towards some sort of turtle. Gary saw the turtle, filmed the turtle, et cetera. You know, this must be a known species. And based on that, then you'll see, obviously you read the book, there are sections in Monster and Marine Mysteries where I covered other sightings of gigantic sea turtles that have taken place, some going back 100 or 200 years. And there's a bunch of them. And they go all the way to the present. In fact, after I finished the book and it had been published, somebody approached me and told me that he and his father had seen, I think it was like 20 years ago or something like that, in Pensacola, Florida, had saw a turtle that matched that size and description off of a pier, and it stole a small shark from a man that was fishing, took it, ran off, bit through his fishing line, and took off. But he saw the head, the neck, and part of the shell, et cetera, and it was immense. But so it seems like, based on all this evidence you put together, that there seems to be this gigantic species of carnivorous, piscivorous turtle out there. Intriguing. I slapped a scientific name on it, Titanicellus lamottii, which is named after Gary LaMotta, who filmed it, which would be, LaMotta's Titanic turtle, basically.
That was one of the just really interesting aspects of your book. Just kind of getting something the audience wasn't expecting in there. And, you know, every once in a while, a couple times over the nearly 20 years I've been in this house, find a turtle along the stream bank. Where the ones would be in our area and they have like little yellow patches on their shell.
Wait, say that again? I'm sorry.
What type of turtle would have the little yellow spots on their shell?
Is it a sea turtle?
No. It's just one that just, I don't know where it came from. Just assume out of the stream.
Is it on land, like
stream.
A tortoise looking? It's in water?
Well, it's...
Like in a pond, a lake?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a painted turtle. It could be a slider, red ear slider, a terrapin. I'd have to, see more than that. As a kid, I had oodles of turtles. I had a pool, a swimming pool of turtles, believe it or not.
Yeah. Wow. They're, maybe 8 inches or so across the shell. They're just, neat little animals, and just kind of move them off the yard, when I'm cutting the grass, and it's kind of make their way down a stream and find another place to stand along the bank.
Mm-hmm.
When you encounter small animals like that, it's a fun experience. But
mm-hmm.
The ones you discuss in your book are just so much. You have a lot of detail in there about diving, what they can swim at 22 miles per hour. You go into so much more detail about their saltwater cousins, and we aren't really expecting to encounter so many, your monster, one of your monsters for this book is a turtle.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. But one of your appearances on Nightlight, it covered the Carnival cruise ship monster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in your book as well, the monsters and marine mysteries. But with setting like in the Gulf of Mexico,
mm-hmm.
You have a lot of people out on boats, or thousands of people who could probably look over the deck and see something huge swimming next to it. You expect Blackbeard and more pirates in the who were traveling to Jamaica and Aruba, the Caribbean. But in this book, you do have a lot of documentation that, there are, the warmer water type sea monsters. But in quite a few examples, you have these high northern latitudes, like the Bay of Fundy, LaMotta's turtle was off the Vancouver Island. Are there more? You have Norway as well with the orcas. We can get into that a little bit. But even though there might be less people on boats in some of these isolated fishing communities along, you know, the Newfoundland coast or something, or have there been more of these sea monsters recorded in the high latitudes, or is it pretty much equal to, you know, what's been documented in the south? Pretty equal. I don't know, is the Gulf Stream washing more of these anomalous beings up onto the coast of Canada? I was just trying to get to, is there anything about the latitudes, cooler versus warm water that attracts
some sightings? I guess you're saying the sightings vary. It seems like some of the sightings that people had that would be more like some sort of like marine crocodile or quote mosasaur type creature tend to historically be in more warmer waters, like around New Zealand, the Gulf of Mexico, which was in late summer, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You get more huge cephalopods. Well, they range all over, but those further up north in colder climates, they can handle colder water. Sea turtles can pretty much go where they want. I mean, the sea turtle thing, I mean, the historical sightings are intriguing. Going back, and I got all the witness statements, there are police reports from going back hundreds of years, some of them 1800s and such. It really seems to be the same animal, not the same exact animal, I mean, but the same species, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I got to stop saying, you know, people tell me that, you know, you keep saying this all the time, you know, I don't know. Do you know? I don't know. Who knows? You know, if you don't know, who knows? But anyway, so at least we haven't, I'm sorry.
No, Nessie would probably be the most famous sea monster. He is also he was started to be sighted in like the 5th, 6th century by a reputable saint.
We should talk about that sighting because
it is a subarctic environment.
Mm-hmm. And it also dates back to the last 10,000 years or something like that from the last ice age, which was when the lock was formed. The thing is that the argument being, of course, that some marine creatures do have access to the lock, however. So, you know, we talk about all this stuff in recent times, sightings and things of the lock, for example. You know, they made this big thing recently and stuff about eels being in the lock. And, the Loch Ness Monster is a giant eel. It's some sort of a eel that is like a eunuch. Yeah. And so it hasn't mated and gone back to the sea, so it's just stayed there and gotten really, really big. Okay? And that's balderdash. That's just like an attempt to promote work, somebody's books, movies, who knows what. Okay. I like look at this and I laugh. First of all, the DNA test that they took there, okay, 20% of the DNA was not even valid. They couldn't even tell what it was. That's the first thing. Okay. Which of course I find interesting, but whatever. And then on top of that, you have like things that don't show up on the DNA tests, but are known to be in the lock. Species of duck. These ducks are there. Why are they not on the DNA test? Seals are known to frequent the lock. They swim in from the outside. You know, they do their thing. They leave. There's no seal DNA or anything like that. I believe that most Loch Ness sightings are the result of Wells catfish. And I'm not the first person that's put this theory out there or anything. Okay. Wells are very serpentine in appearance, long, eel-like, if you want to call it that, et cetera. And that whole thing with the saint where this, you know, creature like, you know, rushed the people, whatever, and stuff. And then he like, you know, chased it away with the power of the divine or whatever you want to call it. But Wells catfish aggressively defend their nesting sites. So there have been, Jeremy Wade showed this on the show, where these girls have been swimming and something grabbed the girl by the leg and pulled her under. And she had like bruising and stuff on her leg, et cetera. And whales have large mouths, pretty powerful jaws. They don't have sharp teeth, but they have those catfish like sandpapery teeth, et cetera. And if you come near their nesting site where they have their eggs, they will attempt to scare you, chase you away. They will bite. And an 8-9 foot catfish trying to bite you would probably be a little disconcerting to me, you know? So, I mean, this thing with the saint was probably a whale's concern about its nest. You know, they're not familiar with this thing, and it's trying to, like, you know, chase the people away. Victorians were famous for stocking whales all over Europe. They're all over parts of Asia, et cetera. They have them in Chernobyl. And despite the radiation, they're fine and huge. I mean, there are some reports of whales' catfish getting to be 15 or 16 feet long. It's a big animal. So, and they have access, the ability to access the lock from the outside, to pass through, to go in there, to feed when they're spawning going on and things like that for the trout and the stuff they feed on. You know, so it makes perfect sense for whales to travel through that area. You might even have a few hanging out in the lock, and they're not being seen often because during the day they tend to nest. They find like fallen timber, structure like that, and they just mesh in with it and they stay there. And there are tons of videos and footage of them just, you know, kind of vegging out in fallen trees and stuff. So if your sonar is going along and you pass over a well that's in a tree, you ain't going to see the catfish. All you're going to see is a tree, basically. You know, this long thing it's resting in there just going to look like part of it. You know, but nighttime comes, they go out, they start prowling around. But if you have wells that are not living there, and yes, they can't spawn in a lock, but they don't need to spawn in a lock. They just need to go there to eat and be seen by people, you know? So, that, I mean, even the fact that the notion of, like, what do you call it, the hump thing, et cetera, you could have multiple wells catfish there, you know, males chasing females, trying to spawn and stuff like that and create that thing, although they have dismissed those humps as boat wakes at this point, you know, but a lot of the sightings, in my opinion, in Loch Ness suggest the wells. And this isn't discussed in the book. I'm just telling you this is my personal opinion. You know, I put this on social media, got attacked by people and all that, you know, oh, giant eel. Yeah, right. Okay, sure. Show me an eel, you know, like that's ever been caught of any kind of immense size, eunuch eel or otherwise. I don't care what this, you know, how this eel identifies or what it identifies as. Okay, it's not going to be 30, 40, 50, 60 feet long, whatever, et cetera. So.
Okay.
Well, next question.
Okay. You were, towards the beginning of the show, you mentioned how your paleo fiction books deal with the dinosaurs working within the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of monsters in marine mysteries deals with ocean creatures. You do cover ponds. You know, I think you last time you were with us, you covered your bathing juvenile Bigfoot pond.
Oh, that was the weirdest day.
Yeah, but you, I just want to touch on snakehead fish. And, you know, throughout the book, people should get a sense of your environmental awareness and have a, like a certain family amusement park type setting with fish.
Mm-hmm.
Too happy
so
with
you.
You
want me, Did you want me to talk about, like, that ape-like creature that I saw in the lake?
How about if we just start with the snakehead and your concerns about environmental ecosystems? Maybe a lot of people aren't aware of them, and I thought you brought up some good points about the snakehead. Then you get into the Bigfoot, bathing Bigfoot thing that you saw.
Mm-hmm. Well, the snakehead incident is based on a fishing trip I took with my dad years back in a lake in New Jersey. And we were, when we brought the boat back to the dock there, I found a large American shad, which are in the lake, floating dead on the surface. And it's like a 16-inch shad. And I scooped it up with a net and sat it on the dock and all, and I was looking at it, measuring it and all this stuff. And, you know, it had a gigantic bite taken out of it. You know, I say a bite, I'm talking a bite like about 5 inches across or something like that. And it was definitely a bite. It had like tooth notch marks, which you can see in the photo. And so something had slammed into this shad, taken its belly out with a bite like that, and just kept going. It didn't consume the whole shad. It was definitely large enough to swallow the whole shad because you could see the size of the gape, let's say. But so I was always curious about what had done this. And the as I started looking at different bite patterns and different, you know, possible candidates, you know, you go through the whole gamut of what could have done this. And it wasn't a person, obviously. I mean, all that. It wasn't a Bigfoot. You know, this is a, you know, developed area and all. But it had to be some sort of aquatic predator of some kind. And that teeth, because like I said, you could see the tooth notches. So a snapping turtle or an alligator snapping turtle was automatically out, based on the fact that the size, the shape of the bite, and there was no beak mark or anything like that, that type of thing. A snapper would have, like, had to tear at the turtle. I mean, I'm sorry, tear at the fish, like, dig its claws in it and try to rip out a chunk, et cetera. Whatever it did, this could have swallowed the shad whole altogether. But it wasn't a turtle of any kind. It had to be some sort of fish, it looked like. And I considered potential candidates, you know, muskellunge and northern pike. None of those were matched. The tooth layout didn't match the shape of the bill that they have on the esox, the muskie or the pike. It's called a bill, the end of their snout, we'll call it. That didn't match up. And whatever did this had the ability to shear through and take it a bite, you know, like Pac-Man, you know. But and one candidate I thought, a fish that I thought was most likely, was a bowfin, which are common and sizable. You know, we've caught 12 pounders in the past, at least down south. But it's got a head that's sort of that shape, et cetera, but it just wasn't big enough. It's, the world record was nowhere near the size of what this animal was. And then I was looking at, like, talking to researchers out there that specialize in the skulls of assorted marine animals and stuff. And I was able to talk to them and get some of their, you know, access to some of their stuff, you know, photos and things of that nature, and of all the different, you know, like anything and everything. And I eventually stumbled on the thing that was a perfect match, which was a snakehead of some kind. And as you mentioned, and it had to be a giant snakehead, not the northern snakehead, which of course is interesting in and of itself for other reasons. But the head, and the shape of the jaws, the notch where they met, the two halves of the maxillary mandible met, it was all there, the tooth shape, positioning, et cetera. And then I was able to take that bite and take an actual photograph of the snakehead and scale it up and match the jaw size to try and calculate the size of the fish that had killed the shad. And I came up with a snakehead that is a giant snakehead that's world record size. And so what I concluded was, and this has happened many times, we know this is how snakeheads first got into Washington, D.C.'s rivers and everywhere else, is that people had them in fish tanks. They were common. I remember in the late 80s living in Brooklyn, and I saw in the aquarium, the pet store I went to, they had three-footers, giant snakeheads, 3 feet long already, in tanks for sale. People were keeping them as pets and stuff. And people got tired of their pets, and they released them into the wild, thinking they were doing them a favor. And the snakehead survived and set up shop, and they've often multiplied, and they've become problems of epic proportions. And a snakehead is very dangerous in its environment because of the fact that it doesn't really have any natural enemies. When they get big, the only fish that could be safer from them or contend with them, let's say, would be a really large pike or a muskellunge or something like that. And even then, they might attack it. I've seen videos, films of them, and they'll go at a fish in a tank or several fish, and they'll hit it like, bam, and they'll bounce off it like a ricochet. And as they bounce off, they tear out a bite, and then they'll hit the next fish, bam, and they take out a huge chunk of it and so forth. And they'll slaughter 3-4 fish in a tank, and there'll be liner twitching and bleeding out and stuff on it. And this thing doesn't eat the whole fish. Sometimes it comes back for more of it and bites another big piece out or half of it or something like that. But they're very destructive in terms of their predatory habits. They have very sharp teeth, very strong jaws, and most of our native fish are not able to defend themselves against these predators. So I concluded that this lake had one or more big snakehead running around in there that is like the apex predator of the lake. And I went back then with my dad on another trip there, and I planned on trying to see if I could hook this thing, or one of them, if there's more than one. And that was when we saw something that really blew my mind. It's an electric-only lake, like 90% of the lakes in that state are. So you're only allowed to use like your trolling motor to putt around, okay? And that's because these lakes are reservoirs. You know, it's drinking water. They don't want the gas and oil and stuff like that in the water. So it was, you know, like getting near, I don't say near sundown, but the sun was starting to drop low. It had been a hot day. And we were down by this one end of the lake, and we saw what initially I thought were two very, very large fish swimming in tandem, swimming together underwater. And they were like 6 feet apart, maybe a little more. And they were moving along, just staying together. Like it was weird, like they were doing a dance where they never left each other's sides, but they kept that distance between them. And it seemed like they were fish because you would see like the water, the turbulence that was churning up from them as they were moving through the water. In retrospect, I realized it wasn't from a fish's body pushing through the water, but something else. But I'll get to that in a second. And, you know, we started following these things. And I thought at first maybe it was a pair of huge carp, you know, like 40-pound, 50-pound carp swimming along together. But that didn't explain the distance. You know, those fish are more school-oriented. They tend to stick closer together. They don't, you know, have like a – they're not practicing safe social distancing, let's say. 6 feet apart, you know, that type of thing, okay? I know it's a terrible joke with the pandemic and stuff, but, you know, this is what we were seeing. And so we started following them. I was using the trolling motor, and I was going to try and get close enough that I was going to try and cast out and get a fishing lure or maybe toss a bait in front of them, you know, like maybe some sweet corn on a hook, which carp like, that type of thing. And I couldn't get close enough because each time I tried to catch up to them, the two fish would change direction and or accelerate. And they were quick when they wanted to be. I could not close the distance to get closer than, I'd say, gosh, maybe I was like 30 feet away. You know, I don't think I ever got closer to 25 feet. But they just kept moving along. So my dad said to me at one point, he's like, hey, Max, you ever think about the possibility that those are two parts of the same animal? And I was like, get out of here. And then I was like looking, I was like, like he had a point. You know, I mean, that would explain why they never left each other's side and why they change. I mean, like when they changed direction, it wasn't like the one, if they were turning left, the one on the left kind of cut left and the other one cut left and then the distance between them narrowed or whatever. It was like they curved together and the one on the outside seemed to go faster to keep up with it. So they were always, like there was a stick between them. You know what I'm saying? Like holding them apart and together. So when I was doing all my research on everything, I realized then what I think this was. is that another popular pet that these aquariums were having at the time was the giant freshwater stingray. And I saw them in that same pet store in Brooklyn that I'm talking about, by the way. And these stingrays, you know, they look real cute when they're in your aquarium when they're 6 inches or a foot across, but they can exceed 7 feet wingspan and weigh God knows how much. I mean, you've probably seen Jeremy Wade slugging it out with one, and he got hurt from it eventually. You know, they're using giant saltwater rigs that are designed for hammerhead sharks and stuff like that, or a mammoth grouper to try and hold these things up on the bottom, but they get gigantic. And so what I believe we saw were the wings of the stingray as it was swimming along. I think whoever released their snakeheads into that lake also put their giant stingray or stingrays in there too. And these things survive, and they feed on the shad and everything else in there. They have a limitless food supply. They're the apex predators. Nothing's messing with them. You know, and they're not going to be fished for, because if you ever snag one or fish hooked one, it's just going to swim away and spool you or snap your line like a spelling thread. And it will. You know, there's no stopping it. You just, you know, it's like trying to hold an elephant by you grabbing it by the tail. You know, if it doesn't turn and step on you, it's just going to keep going, and you're going to like hang there like an idiot and eventually get shaken off or something. So my point is that's what it looks like. And when I studied the stingray swimming, you can see the edges, the outer edges of their wings undulate, and that's how they propel. They propel. And that's the same type of water disturbance that I was seeing on the left and the right from what I thought were fish. See? Unfortunately, the water was muddy and all that. So, this thing never came close enough to the surface that I think the water was probably 8 or 10 feet deep in that section, let's say. But if it was a giant freshwater stingray, and I'm pretty convinced it was, it was a big beast. I went back looking for it myself like a week or two later, and I had a bow and arrow with the kind you use for fishing. And I figured I'm going to prove one way or another if this is what I think it is, and I'm just going to shoot dead center between these two, quote, fish. And if it is that, you know, if the arrow will go deep enough and embed, you know, being for one hell of a Nantucket sleigh ride, because I would have had to tie off that 100-pound, you know, cable off to, like, my bow or something like that and just let it tow the boat around until hopefully it got tired, although it might eventually just break the line and whatnot, you know. But, I haven't been back there since then, to be honest. I didn't see it that time that I went by myself, which is probably a good thing, but, if it's still alive, it's been a few years now, it's huge. I mean, I think it weighs 600-700 pounds. And people laugh and say it's impossible. The snakeheads are definitely there. So, I mean, it makes sense that from what we experienced that this stingray is in there too. Imagine catching that, making the news. That'd be like the largest fish ever caught in the lake in the United States.
Well, okay. Yeah, you're used to that kind of celebrity fishing status since you do hold world records.
Well, I don't go on shows fishing and stuff like that. I do have an interesting clip from a few years back of me fighting an alligator on rod and reel. I should put that on the site, because we were the last time I took the girls down to Florida, we were fishing this place called the Stick Marsh. A couple 100-pound gator came up, and we're using golden shiners for bait. It's like a 8-10 inch long bait fish to catch largemouth. And this nuisance alligator came up and just snagged, you know, grabbed one of the shiners and got hooked. And I did not want to cut the line and leave him with, you know, 100 feet of 50-pound Power Pro braided line, you know, hanging from his mouth, which could have gotten around his neck and killed him or something. So I was fighting the gator on rod and reel until, as expected, the hook popped out and, you know, he swam away. But he was a pain in the butt. Let me tell you.
You have all kinds of amazing stories.
Well, you know, I'm just like a magnet for problems, I guess. You know,
but with some of the examples that. Other examples you have in your book about
the Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, you do mention Bigfoot and ET, couple references about E.T.
Well, that was in relation to that giant sea creature that they saw that was, like, attacking fishermen and stuff. I mean, the Bigfoot, thing I saw on the lake was some sort of anthropoid. So.
Do you want to talk about that? You want to get into other...
Whatever you think aspects. Your listeners want to hear.
Okay. I think they heard the Bigfoot story last time when you were a guest.
Well, you don't want to do that then.
Right.
Well, I don't want to be repetitious.
I was trying to find the drawing. It's the one where there are like a great white going after a shark from above, and then you do have a couple samples of the pygmy blue whale with a huge bite mark taken out of its back. And throughout the book, you are basically profiling killer fish. And if we go back in time and look at evolution, you do have the Shaunosaurus skeleton photo from the Nevada State Museum. What does the evolutionary record tell us about how these sea creatures go after their next meal? Has it changed over time?
Are you talking about like a Shastasaurus, like an ichthyosaurus feeding apparatus?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so
well, I guess
like
it depends on the...
It's like sometimes they're attacking from above. That's why you have some of the bite marks, the photos of bite marks taken out of the back of the tail. So sometimes they're coming up from the underneath of their victim, like Alex Kintner. Has these fish behaviors changed over time, or is it pretty much this is the way it's always been to get your next meal?
Okay. Well, an ichthyosaur isn't a fish. It's a marine reptile.
Okay.
Like a dolphin, but reptilian, warm-blooded, based on evidence, with a long proboscis, we'll call it, elongated maxillary mandible, very long to help them snatch fish, which is interesting because I'm not going to go into all that, but it's it's not a fish. They ate fish and squids and ammonites and all sorts of stuff like that, and they probably came up behind their prey and were snapped it up with a quick snap to the left or the right, like anything else it draws, like a gharial will do, let's say, or false gharial, with type of crocodilian. But like feeding strategies vary from animal to animal, species to species. That I investigated that had to do with plesiosaurs, for example, was that I developed a theory that a plesiosaur had the ones with the long necks, like, quote, Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, when she's not a Wells catfish or an eel and all that. But a plesiosaur morph, the ones with the elongated necks, like Elasmosaurus, et cetera, They have these ridiculously long necks, and then the question is why? Now, what's the benefit of that? And my theory was that it wasn't to sneak up on prey, generally speaking. It was designed to offset or defeat the fish's lateral line. Fish have a sensory organ, sharks even have it, that goes from their jaws pretty much to the back towards their tail, caudal, on one each side, and this lateral line lets them sense changes in water pressure around them. So they're able to detect the approach of something. And this is why when you see fish swimming along together in a school, they can do basically what's like murmuration in birds. The whole school can change direction at the same time, and they're not crashing into one another. It's not, a million-car pileup, if you know what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, right.
So the lateral line lets them do that. It lets them sense things in the dark, and they can sense approaching predators. They can also sense a large predator coming up behind them with their lateral line because of the displaced water. So I put out a theory about this, and we even tested the theory for plesiosaurs that their head was about the size of the upper scale of the fish that they would eat. So when a plesiosaur would come up behind a school of fish and its head is like 20 feet ahead of its body, let's say, and the big body is way back there, the fish in that school aren't feeling the pressure buildup from the water being displaced by the plesiosaur's body. They're only feeling the water being displaced by its face. And to them, their senses pick it up as just another member of the school. So they're not alarmed. They don't change direction. They don't scatter, et cetera. So the plesiosaur is able to basically graze on fish. They can follow the school and just pluck the stragglers off the back of the school one by one, keep following the school, and eating until it's full. It's a perfect system if you think about it. The plesiosaur gets unlimited feeding, and the fish survive because the slower and weaker members of the shoal are consumed. See? And the lateral line is not alarmed. The fish is not alarmed by the presence of the plesiosaurs, like I said, because it thinks it's just another member. You know, oh, that's just Harry behind me. Oh, no, Harry, what happened? You know, that kind of thing. But so this made perfect sense. So to test the theory, we got the closest thing, footage of the closest thing that we could find, which would be a snake-neck turtle. And snake-neck turtles are almost like plesiosaurs. They have a long neck and head and then the turtle body and the webbed feet, et cetera. And then we get the footage and we see like the turtle coming up behind these fish. And when it comes up behind the fish and its head is approximately the size of the fish are not alarmed. They don't notice the turtle's approach. They don't run. And it grabs one, but no problem, okay? On the other hand, if the turtle is coming straight at the fish and they can see it with their eyes, they run for their lives. And if the fish were tiny, where the turtle's head was preternaturally large compared to them, so almost like a shark coming at a mackerel or something like that, then even with their backs turned, the lateral line still warned them of the approaching turtle, and they were able to flee and evade it. So the theory was basically proven by using the snake-neck turtle this way. And, my theory must be spot on because a group of paleontologists from Germany, Sander et al., actually featured remarkably similar stuff in their paper about it. You know, like the same type of stuff I explained about it, following the school and, feeding on the fish on the back of the school and not being detected because of the head being the same size and all this stuff. So I'm very flattered that my stuff's getting out there more into the mainstream and being accepted by actual paleontologists. You know, must be inspired by my work. Know what I mean?
Well, who wouldn't be?
Well, thank you.
But I really did enjoy Monsters and Marine Mysteries, and we have other unique cases to get to, but I'm sure everyone's familiar with the captain's logs, not Captain Kirk's, but you know, you get all these records, you know, documentation of, you know, the glowing objects going through the Caribbean oceans, you know, from Columbus, you know, Blackbeard and mermaids and Captain Blood. You know, there's a lot of, you know, these famous captains' journals that, you know, really revealed some really interesting sightings that puzzle us today until you came along and resolved everything that was documented from the 18th century that seemed to be like some kind of anomaly. But you know, when you interview you know, someone like Earl and his leather back turtle story, some of the other people, the Carnival Cruise Monster witness, are a lot of these people credible when you talk to them? Is there the same credibility as, you know, name any of the 18th century, 17th to 18th century captains who noted some type of anomaly? But is there a consistency with, I'm taking this pretty seriously.
I'm pretty good at detecting hoaxes. You know, I have what you call a bullshit detector, let's say. And I'll give you an example. I was approached by a gentleman from the Philippines. And it's a few years back. And there have been some photos making the rounds, a couple of them, of this, what looked like some sort of big reptilian-like carcass that had come ashore, drifted into the shallows or whatever in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's all this conversation on social media and such, you know, what is this thing and blah, 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 all sort of stuff. And eventually, like, some marine biologist stepped in. She said it to her, she felt it was a gray whale and that it was rotting. And so the, you know, the flesh was like melting and deteriorating or whatever and moved around and just looked really bizarre. Okay. But I was this guy approached me and he had this fantastical story. He said that this carcass came ashore right outside his house. Like, his house was right off the beach. And he came out in the morning, and he was the first person on site before anybody else. And he claimed that he put on scuba gear, which he had, and he went out and he swam around it. And what? And he claimed that it had teeth in its jaws, upper and lower. I have it all in Facebook and Messenger, because it was a Facebook Messenger conversation, okay? And mm-hmm. that it had four flippers, but one was missing. It had been torn off or bitten off. It was, you know, heavily deteriorated. It had leathery but scaly skin, little scales on it when you got up close, and a few other things. And then he told me that the military had come, don't they always, Men in Black stuff, whatever, and that they had dragged the carcass ashore with a rope, and that once it was on shore, it broke apart because it was so rotted, which made sense to me at this point. And then they used backhoes and all this stuff to scoop up the carcass and deposit it on a flatbed, and then they left with it, supposedly to some research facility, et cetera. That was the last he heard from it. And he was telling me how he was going to go to the beach where this had taken place, and he was going to, I asked him, because I wanted DNA. Okay, I was still believing his story at this point. And, you know, I wanted to prove, I said, is there some teeth, some skin, some fragments, whatever, and stuff. And he was like, he went back, he said, no, he couldn't find anything. I find it a little hard to believe. Okay, that's, you know, I mean, the things, I don't say blood, but tissues, the stuff melting would have soaked into the sand. Unless they scooped up the sand several feet deep to go with it, there should have been something. But anyway, so that was the story, and that was his fantastic claim. Unfortunately for him, as this was being told to me over the next day, someone else from the Philippines sent me a slew of photographs of this carcass, which I haven't, you know, posted or anything like that. I couldn't use them in the book because I didn't have the person's contact information anymore, and, you know, there's copyright issues. I could probably put them on social media under fair use for educational purposes, and I probably will. But there was, I have several dozen photos of this carcass. And the thing that was interesting is that there is footage of them, or stills of them, let's say, a bunch of fishermen and stuff, putting a rope around the carcass out, you know, I'd say, gosh, 1,000 feet from the island, nearest island, and eventually dragging it out to sea. So, you know, his story obviously was balderdash, okay? And the photos are interesting because I'm looking at it and you can see what is obviously a closed eye. And then ahead of that is a nostril. And, you know, some crypto guy was claiming that, oh, it's a sperm whale. You can see the lower jaw, the mandible with the sockets where the teeth were. And I'm looking at these photos, and this, what he's claiming is a mandible, is a piece of trash, like a plastic, hard plastic strip with holes in it that's sort of sticking out of the front of the carcass, you know, like flotsam that it gets stuck to it. It's not even bone. It's plastic or something like that, or aluminum siding. I don't know what, you know. But so there's always somebody out there that thinks they know everything. But anyway, but when I looked at it, and I was remembering what this woman said about it being a gray whale, that didn't jive because the eye is so big compared to the rest of the skull, and the distance from the eye to this nostril or blowhole, whatever it is, and such, is like if you compare a gray whale, and I chart these things out. It's just anatomically impossible. I don't care how much this thing's face shifts and melts from rotting, et cetera. You know, the distance from the blowhole to the eye can't change that much, let alone the eye quintupling in size. It just, that doesn't happen. Eyes don't grow after you're dead, okay? So it's definitely not a gray whale, in my opinion. And it's very curious what it could be. And I know of some cetacean expert who's, you know, willing to accept the challenge and look at this thing and try and confirm one way or the other what it is. Now, maybe some kind of whale. It's sizable. The head is big. The head looks like it's about 10 feet long, I guess. But the head does kind of look a little reptilian, you know. It has, like, this blackish skin where it's not rotted away. It's kind of shiny, which does match the witness's description of the skin on the Carnival Cruise Monster. But, you know. You know, the odds are it's some sort of whale carcass, but it doesn't look like what, you know, people have dismissed it as, although they may have dismissed it just based on the limited photos they had and not the stuff that I've been sitting on. But back to the hoaxer, the point is, so I got this guy on there, and I said to him, yeah, I really appreciate your time and, you know, all the details about this, you know, your encounter with this thing is really incredible. You know, I just wish I could have gotten you some, you know, whatever, some evidence and stuff. I said, yeah, what do you think about this photo or this one? I sent him a couple of them. I'm like, you know, it's really strange. You were the first person on the scene, and the carcass was right there, practically beached, you said. And then you guys tied a rope about it, the military did, and they dragged it ashore and it broke apart. But I'm showing these guys that are got this rope around this thing, and I got stills of them towing it out to sea. I'm a little confused. Can you explain to me how this happened? He's like, where'd you get these photos from? Like this episode, I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, so everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame and blah, 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 blah. Hoaxers, 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 okay? That's why we have, like, you know, like the Loch Ness Monster growing crab feet as supposed fangs and stuff like that, okay? It's all BS. You know, I don't work like that, okay? But, you know, when I interviewed the guy that saw the Carnival Cruise Monster, I put him through the ringer. I mean, literally, I tried to play mental chess with him and, like, to trip him up. You know, like, there's a lot of conversations we had that aren't in the book and stuff. And I would rehash stuff and this and see if his story changed or anything like that, you know. And I never encountered anything that made me sense that he wasn't telling the truth. We had phone conversations also, Skype conversations, et cetera. And he was just really, like when he talked about the size and strength, the power of this thing, he's like, he's from England, so I'm going to try and do his voice. He's like, my God, Mike, this thing was the biggest thing you ever saw. I mean, like, Super Predator, forget it. This thing, a 9-foot shark wouldn't even fit it up. You understand what I'm saying? When it surfaced, it was like a submarine. I mean, like, his back was so big, water was pouring off it, just like you see when a sub surfaces. Gigantic, you know, and that type of stuff. So, you know, he was very, I mean, like, excited when he speak about it. Like, he could still see it in his mind. So I'm not impossible to fool, but I'm pretty confident that he saw what he saw, you know. And it's been several years, and I've periodically speak with him, and nothing, he's never slipped up, nothing ever. You know, people always make mistakes when they tell lies. You know, they forget some details, they change their story, they, you know, tweet things, whatever. It's never happened. So anything's possible, but I think he's telling the truth.
Okay. All right.
That's my feeling on it, Mike. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, you know, this thing, he was bloody huge. Oh, my God. Yeah. Bigger than a whale. And he'd seen all the whales, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
I was impressed with your impersonation of him. And discriminating about, you know, the information. You know, you just can't just publish anything just because, you know, they say, well, I saw it. Well,
right. I mean, that's right. And I've had people try and hoax me before. I mean, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
You know, some guy was supposed to be a guest on my show that we used to do and stuff, and he was claiming he saw this gigantic turtle and all this stuff. And his story was really fishy, you know. And of course, the last minute he backed out of, you know, appearing on the show. You know, I would have pinned him down live on the air and gotten to the bottom of it and stuff. So, you know, but I mean, you know, everybody, you see these hoaxes all the time. It happens, you know, Bigfoot, and it's like some guy wearing like a sleeping bag running around in the distance with these grainy photos, and you can't see anything. I mean, seriously,
uh-huh.
It's embarrassing, some of them. And this doesn't mean that Sasquatch doesn't exist or is real. You know, some of these people just want to have their little fame and laugh and say, oh, I trolled the world and I tricked all these people. Look, I got like 50,000 likes and stuff for this photo of me wearing a snowmobile suit and you know, with a blurry setting or something like that, you know?
Yep.
But, or there are people that just want to make people think that Bigfoot is just BS so that it sways the public from really believing in the creature.
It's their only video on their YouTube channel, and you know, it's you know, there are those types out there. I've had to deal with the people suffering from severe cases of pareidolia, but things that other samples you have in Monsters and Marine Mysteries that aren't hoaxes because you have frames of a video and it's another creature that you may have only referenced just briefly, but it seems like a manatee was pulled under
the water. Sanibel Island.
Sanibel Sea Beast.
Mm-hmm.
So we just heard that, okay, you have to deal with some of the those types who are looking for attention. But, okay, we have a real video tape of this. Let's talk little bit about the Sanibel movie that you analyze in your book. Let's get into another type of sea monster.
So you want to talk about that one, or you want to talk about something else?
No, that one. Yeah, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay, I'm sorry. I don't have the thing in front of me. The date, I think it was around 2012 or 2013, if memory serves. But this couple, they were engaged, I think, at the time. They were out. They had a rented boat off Sanibel Island, Florida, and they were cruising along, and they saw a bunch of manatees. And the girl, she was videotaping them while her fiance was handling the boat and all. And they turned the engine off to not speak to manatees. And then, according to them, something very large passed under their boat at high speed. And they said it was the size of a bus, but not that thick. To David Carlin, is now the husband, they're a married couple. And he said it was probably about 4 feet thick, but passed under their boat. And when it got close to the manatees, something shot out of it, like a telephone pole, wrapped around a manatee and dragged it under. That's basically the short version of the story. And so if you look at the video footage, oh, and then his girlfriend was terrified. You could hear the video. She was like freaking out. She wanted to get the heck out of there and stuff. And she, rightfully so. So the question was that really what happened? Does the video show that or not? And what is this thing if it's true? Okay. So interesting thing is that the video quality is pretty crappy. And David had told me during our interview that he didn't know why, but his original video was in HD. And then when they gave it to someone to upload it to YouTube, the quality went downhill. He had no explanation for why that had happened. But, what I found interesting was I wanted to see what this was. And I encourage anybody, you look up Sanibel Sea Serpent or something like that, any of your listeners on YouTube, you'll find the video right away on your websites and stuff for it. And when you see this sudden splash, you know, at first, like most people, oh, it's just a manatee rolling and stuff like that. But if you look, something seems off. And you kind of see, but it seems like the manatee, something does curl over it, and then it gets straight under, like that. And as it gets pulled under, you see its flippers, its tail, appear on the left, like it's flailing, it looks like. It's yanked under. And then a second or two later, the head pops up on the right, which is where the head would be, if you know. So I don't know, it's trying to get air or something, and then it's pulled under and doesn't come back. Okay. So there's an air breather, obviously. Something grabbed you and dragged you under, you'd be gasping for air, you'd be trying to catch your breath while you were trying to free yourself. So I'm looking at this and I'm trying to figure out what exactly this is. Is this really not just a manatee? Is it just, you know, they thought it was some sort of immense snake, you know, and the dark on the top, light underneath, I think was the description, et cetera. And so as I was going through the frames, you know, I was doing the same thing that I started doing with the Gary LaMotta footage. You know, I was taking the frames one by one, and I would click enhance on my computer, and that would make things pop better. And as I did this, I started seeing these, it really stands out in color. I mean, in the book, it's black and white. I started seeing what in film is called fogging on a bunch of frames. And fogging is, the easiest way to explain it would be, like, if you see somebody who's testifying against a mafia guy, and he's speaking and they have his face blocked out with like pixels and they probably distort his voice longer. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's fogging. If you shoot a video and there's people in the background and they won't give you permission to use their image, you know, you fog their faces, et cetera. Okay. And so there was this was done. And I kept looking at it, and it was in a bunch of frames. It's all in the book. I did it frame by frame by frame to show it. You can see it's like a square that's fogged, okay, like pixels broken down, okay? And in several frames, there's several fogging boxes, okay? And it's so strange because, you know, Dave's wife, I had spoken to her, and she said that they didn't do anything to the video, and I don't think they did, but I think somebody might have. Because first off, he already told me that the video lost quality before it came up. And in addition to that, you've got this weirdness going on. And this fogging seems to block all the frames where the juicy parts would be visible. Like if this was something wrapped around its manatee, the spots we need to see that we could kind of figure out what it was is obscured. I find that to be a remarkable coincidence. Now, I don't want to sound like a, quote, conspiracy theorist and all that stuff, but it's there. I mean, the frames aren't lying or anything like that. They don't come out normally, but when you enhance them, it separates the layers, and it pops out at you then. So it's been done. And whoever did it, in my opinion, okay, was really good at it. Like, it was a professional job of obscuring these 6 or 10 frames or whatever it was, okay? And so I was looking at this, and based on my interview with Dave and what he saw and all this other stuff, you're trying to figure out what this could be. The fact that he said it was the size of a bus and it was 4 feet thick made me think, okay, it's not a snake. Because a 4-foot snake would be insanely big. I mean, think about it. It would have to be 100, 200 feet long. I'm just guessing, depending on species, you know, if its body was 4 feet thick. It has to be something else. And it says, they also describe something shooting out of it. And so that sounded to me like a cephalopod, a cuttlefish, an octopus, or possibly the most likely candidate, a squid of some kind. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, if you had a giant squid, an Argonautus or something else, another species, and its body was 4 feet thick. Picture from the ground to 4 feet thick, a picture of a squid lying of it that thick. That is a ginormous squid. And 40 feet in length would probably jibe with that. So, and squid have, a lot of them, including Arctuthis, have retractable feeding tentacles. So squid actually have 10 appendages. 8 of them are what they call the arms. These are the shorter ones that protrude down under the mantle, and they use those for manipulating and holding prey and, you know, pushing it toward their beak and stuff, okay? And then they have, depending on species, okay, they some of them also have these two elongated feeding tentacles. And in the case of fish like cuttlefish do this, some other squids do this, Architeuthis has this, where these tentacles are kept retracted in there. And when it sort of comes within range of a prey item, they kind of Velcro together, like they have these special suckers on them that let them hold together, and they launch out like a jab from a box or something like that, like whoosh, out. And then at the end of it, they have what they call clubs, like it's kind of like a palm-shaped end of the tentacle, which has often suckers that have like teeth in them, like either on the edges or depending on the colossal squid, actual whole curved hooks, etc. And this mechanism, these feeding clubs at the end of the tentacles, as it impacts on the target, open like a mouth, and it snaps onto the prey item and latches onto it and then pulls it toward the squid, where its arms entangle it up, completely immobilizing it, and then the squid starts to systematically eat it alive with its beak, ripping chunks out and grinding them up with its tongue and swallowing it pieces. That's how it works, okay? And that seems to make the most sense in terms of, you know, if we're not looking at a manatee rolling, and it doesn't appear that we are, okay, then I would think some sort of large cephalopod, like a cuttlefish or a squid, was feeding on manatees. And the 40-foot length was the overall mass of the cephalopod passing underneath the Carlin's boat. And what shot out of it that they said described as being like the size of a telephone pole were the actual feeding tentacles launching toward the manatee. It grabs it, it wraps around it, it pulls it under, and it begins to consume it. Okay? So that's my theory on it.
Okay. So telephone pole size tentacles. That's pretty large. It doesn't look like it would be, you can see the shoreline. It's a...
Yeah, there's islands.
Seems like,
yeah, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, it seems like a pretty large predator close to shore.
Yeah, the water depth is in the book. I don't know off the top of my head. I think it might have been like 20 feet. I'm just guessing 24 feet. You probably know better than me because you have it in front of you. But, you know, it's like I mentioned this, like I've seen like past, like studies people have done where they, in Hawaii, where they claimed that they spotted giant octopuses, like commonly. And the appearance of the octopuses seems to coincide with the migration, the nesting of the green sea turtle. And green turtles, the, you know, they get big, the size and all that's in the book. The 600-pound turtle, it's relatively slow moving, especially if it's coming in to lay eggs or is tired and just laid eggs. You know, it would make sense that a predator like that would want some sort of large, meaty meal that it could easily catch and overpower. And an octopus's beak is perfectly capable of shearing through the plastron, that's the underbelly of a turtle, with no problem. That beak can sniff through steel wire, for God's sake. And, you know, a perfect meal. So if you think about it, if you had something like that all around Sanibel Island, that region, then a manatee is just as good, if not better. I mean, they're big and slow and blubbery and pretty much defenseless, you know? And you don't have good fangs to defend themselves and claws, and but it's just like a big, fat sausage swimming around. And if you're an opportunistic predator, you learn from past experience, oh, this is where I'm going to get a nice, easy meal, you know, it makes sense that it might go to and do that. So,
okay. Yeah, you do note it's 16 to 24 feet deep. Yeah, it's pretty scary. You know, it's get stuff way out. Yeah, you have these creatures way out to sea and near the shoreline too.
Well, the interesting thing about the Sanibel one is that like a year later or something around that same time, there was somebody else who saw a gigantic octopus right there, like not a few miles away offshore from a fishing boat. It's in the book too. But, and he told me that when they called it in, like they were on, they had like a 55-foot, I believe it was, like charter fishing boat, and they were like drifting along using what he described as disgustingly smelling bait, like, you know, to catch fish and stuff. And apparently that attracted the thing. And then all of a sudden, 30 feet of a tentacle comes up on the surface of the water, swims toward them, squirms towards them, and it starts like touching the side of their boat. And as I explained to Demetrius, was his name, him and his multiple friends of his all saw this thing. And they said that it was like a reddish brown color, kind of smooth, and it was up to 3 feet thick. And they only saw 30 feet of it. And then they could see it going beneath the surface. There was more of the tentacle. They saw other tentacles under there and some sort of body shape. And they estimated that the animal was like 80 or even 90 feet, including its tentacles. They saw the outline and stuff under the boat, beside the boat. But and he thought he was just being curious. You know, that's what he said. And I explained to him that octopuses or octopi, whichever you prefer, have chemoreceptors in their suckers, which is a taste bud. And so when it was touching the boat, it was trying to determine if the boat was a living thing or not. You know, it smelled like this nasty, fishy oil and blood and stuff like that, you know. And then it realized it was metal or fiberglass, whatever the boat was made out of, and then it withdrew and it went on its merry way. It might have been checking to see if it was a whale, in which case it might have lashed, you know, around it and stuff and tried to drag it under.
Yeah, and that's the one where your case study where they saw like a garbage can lid eyeball looking. This was like
That's not the same. No, that was the Starkey squid incident during World War II on the Admiralty trawler.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and that one was just an amazing story. Just you're looking down at and you into the water and you see this huge eyeball looking back up at you. I think one of the nice parts of your book is you're covering all kinds of these creatures that are out there. They're still there. Be careful at the beach. But, it's an amazing universe underwater, too.
Well, the Starkey incident was – oh, I'm sorry. There was one other thing about the Sanibel thing about the oculus that Dimitri and his friend saw. And that was I forgot to mention this, is that it's in the book. They called it in, the harbor master or whatever it was and stuff, and said, listen, we got a gigantic octopus or something, stick its tentacle up and, you know, it's like exploring our boat and all this stuff like that. And the guy was like, oh, yeah, we know. It's been here for a few days already. Something like that. And, you know, like, well, thanks for warning us. You know, like, you wouldn't want to fall in the water with that thing. I mean, for God's sake, you might saw a person, an hors d'oeuvre, you know, no whale to eat, but this is, you know, but the Starkey thing was intriguing to me because this story takes place during World War II in the Maldives, if memory serves. And this guy's up on deck, night watch and stuff. And they have submarine lights underwater there. Mm-hmm. And this is like lights that are on the sides of the ship and stuff on the hull. And they're designed to create the illusion to break up the ship's profile and make it look like something other than it is by trying to make it blend with the like the horizon, that type of thing. That was like a technology they used back then. But squid are, you know, respond to bioluminescence. When they first got actual footage of a live giant squid attracted the bait, they used a special, like, a color-emitting, like, a Medusa thing, whatever they call it, their Gorgon light show underwater to draw it in. Because squid communicate by flashing and colors and things of that nature. And so these Admiralty trawler, those lights may have drawn this creature, unless Starkey was Stark, raving mad. Get it? Starkey, Stark, raving mad. That's not funny. But anyway... but he said he was up on deck smoking a cigarette or something, and he looked over the side, and he saw this glowing green orb, like the size of a trash can lid, like just underwater there. And he was looking, he's like, what am I looking at here? And then eventually he realized to his shock and horror that it was an eye. And then he stepped back a little bit, he realized the eye was part of a squid, a gigantic, impossibly large squid. And he was backing away from it in fear. And he realized that it was lying next to the boat. And they were just, I think, drifting at this point. And he realized it went from one end of the trawler to the other, which was over 175 feet. So it sounds impossible, but that's what, you know, he reported. And then he said all of a sudden the squid's body kind of like swelled up, which was it sucking in water into its mantle and what. And then it just silently just sped away underwater with nary a ripple.
Okay, with a story like that, the squid attacking the Nautilus in 20,000 leagues under the sea really isn't make believe fiction.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I don't know if Jules Verne had an encounter like that when he was out on the ocean, but since we have been talking a little bit about some of the old captain's journals, I'm sure he was very, he's a pretty smart guy. He did a lot of reading, and he may have come across something like that that, you know, you're verifying that it may be very realistic to put in a, you know, one of the grandfather of sci-fi books.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I'm not sure, because the Pearl incident, which was when a schooner was attacked and sunk by a squid that was even bigger than it, is in Monsters and Marine Mysteries. And I don't know if that took place before he wrote 20 Dozen Leagues Under the Sea or not, but if it did, and it quite may well have, that may have inspired him for, you know, that part of his book. You know what I'm saying, but I don't know. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know everything, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah, Max, we're down to about 3 minutes left. Do you want to plug your websites and Facebook pages, get people to know where, how to get a hold of you? And, you know, I do want to thank you for a very educational evening. This is what Night Light's all about. And
well, I do tend to go off on my tangents and whatnot, but thank you. Sure. If anybody, first off, all the books, the Cronus Rising series, Diablo, all that stuff, is available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble. There's Kindles, there's full-size soft covers. I think Barnes & Noble still has some hard covers. Monsters and Marine Mysteries is also available through them. I'm very proud. The book was my first number one bestseller, which is surprising considering all the novels I've written. But I guess people said they liked the fact that the stories were told in an exciting way, you know, by a storyteller, instead of being more methodical and preachy and what. You know, you try and make it exciting for people. Nobody wants to read boredom. But so you can go on my website too. Hmm?
It's a really good book.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The website, if people want to go on my site, it's either CronusRising.com, which you mentioned, or MaxHawthorne.com. And there are free book downloads, excerpts on there, et cetera. A lot of the books, I think if you have like Amazon's Kindle Unlimited program, you can actually read the Kindle verses for free, which a lot of people love and take advantage of. So that's always welcome. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me personally, on Facebook, I'm Max Hawthorne Author, if I'm not mistaken. Same thing on Instagram. I have no idea what my Twitter one is, but I'm sure it's something similar. I have a couple groups. There's the main Cronus Rising fan page, which is like Max Hawthorne's Cronus Rising novel series or something like that. And I don't, you know, manage it, to be honest, but I'm pretty sure if you look up that up, you'll find it. And there is one group that I personally handle, which is Max Hawthorne's Monsters and Marine Mysteries, hence the name of the book. And that we have a lot of great members. They post all sorts of sightings and things they've seen and intriguing aquatic critters and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's a nice group. We keep it clean. We don't allow foul language in there or bullying or anything like that. You know, it's they're great, honestly. I have some really fantastic readers.
Yeah, good group of people. We're down to under a minute, and you know, thanks again. You're always welcome back to discuss the lizard by the pond and your walk with Caesar in the cemetery. So you know, let's save those for next time. But
sure.
Thanks again, and you know, we have some great shows. You know, the 21st Century shows lined up tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday. So I'll see everyone next Tuesday with Dan and Teresa Duke. And thanks, Barbara. Thank you, Max. And have a great night.